Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us here. Sorry for the slight delay. We just a small technical issue, but I'm very pleased to welcome you to this press briefing here at the UN office at Geneva. Today, the 27th of January, we have a short but very important briefing. Very pleased to have with us James Elder of UNICEF, our friend, who is going to speak to the situation in Gaza, particularly the UNICEF's education drive. We also have an announcement from our colleague David from the ITU, but I'm going to go right to you, James, and nice to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Well, and you. Good morning, everyone. Hopefully some good news. Today, UNICEF is scaling up learning in Gaza in one of the largest emergency learning efforts anywhere in the world. Our Back to Learning program is going to expand to include 336,000 children. Now, this is not a nice to have, it's an emergency. As many of you know, almost 2.5 years of attacks on Gaza schooling have left an entire generation at risk. 60% of school-aged children currently have no access to in-person learning. And of course, more than 90% of schools have been damaged or destroyed. Before this war on children, Palestinians in Gaza had some of the highest literacy rates in the world. Education was a source of pride, resilience, and progress for generations. Today, that legacy is very much under attack. Schools, universities, and libraries have been destroyed, and years of progress have been erased. This isn't just physical destruction, it is an assault on the future itself. In the aftermath of this brutal war, rebuilding Gaza's schools, their education facilities, and of course, Gaza's universities must sit at the very top of Gaza's recovery agenda. Restoring education restores possibility. So today, UNICEF with education partners in Gaza at the Palestinian Ministry of Education is launching Back to Learning to restore access to education for hundreds of thousands of children. We're working with the PA Ministry of Education, with UNRWA and all those partners to ensure eventually that all children return to safe learning environment as soon as possible. Now, some certainly ask, why focus on education when families still struggle for food, for water, for shelter? Well, firstly, this is not either or. UNICEF has, for instance, delivered 1 million thermal blankets in the last few months, hundreds of thousands of winter clothing kits for children. We've opened more than 70 nutrition centres across Gaza, whilst our work to get water and water treatment plants back up and running remains a real flagship intervention. But secondly, because in Gaza, learning is life-saving. These learning centres provide safe spaces in a territory that's often inaccessible and dangerous. They restore vital information. They deliver routine for children. They connect girls and boys to health, to nutrition and protection services. And these UNICEF learning spaces have proper toilets and places to wash hands, some of the basics that many, many children in shelters simply do not have. Now, make no mistake, the demand is overwhelming. Every existing learning centre has long waiting lists. When I was in Gaza 2 weeks ago, I had dozens of parents outside learning centres pleading for places for their children. Children often show up anyway. So as the world talks about how Gaza is going to recover, how Gaza will rebuild, UNICEF is very, very clear. Children have to be at the heart of every plan. We know that half of the population, almost half of Gaza's population, is under 18. Now, getting one child into a UNICEF learning centre costs just around $280 for a year, including mental health support. So to reach 336,000 children for the rest of this year, UNICEF urgently needs $86 million. $86 million, to put in some sort of global perspective, is roughly what the world spends on coffee in an hour or two. So with that number in mind, let's be clear what's at stake. Gaza has one of the highest literacy rates in the world. The engineers who are rebuilding those water systems right now, the doctors who've been saving lives over 2 years of this horrific war, the teachers who will steady the next generation of children, they all come from a proud culture of learning. Back to learning, then, it's not just about survival. It's about protecting the engine of Gaza's future. And it's a bridge, not a substitute, for the full restoration of Gaza's schools so that every child can return to a formal education in a classroom. But right now, back to learning is about keeping that flame alive, giving children routine, giving them dignity and direction again. It's about how hope becomes practical. It's how a future gets rebuilt. Thank you.
Thank you very much, James. You know, learning is life-saving, as you said, and it's such a small amount, really, put things in perspective. $86 million is really a small investment for such a worthy cause. So thank you very, very much for those messages. We'll take questions. We have a few in the room. We'll start off with Christiane DPA, German News Agency.
Thank you, James. Good to see you. Just some housekeeping about the numbers. 336 children out of how many? What is the total? And you mentioned 60%. I did not quite understand. 60% had no access during these 2.5 years? Or does this represent 60%? So if you could just be more clear about the numbers. And then what kind of schools do you have now? Is this in tents? Is this in ruins? Or what does that look like? What about the staff? Who are the teachers? Are those the teachers from before? Are they still alive? Do they have the capacity to teach while they are still struggling to look after their own families? What exactly is the situation? Are you bringing in teachers from outside? Thank you.
Christiane, thank you. Pertinent questions. Okay, numbers. Let me try and work from the top down. 700,000 school-age children in Gaza. Now, of that, around half of those previously attended UNRWA schools. And so they remain a priority for programming for UNRWA. So that's around half. Then we'll look at the other half. The other, let's just 350,000. UNICEF is aiming to get 336,000 of those into temporary learning spaces. We've got 135,000 in now. So we're trying to go from 135,000, about a 150% increase, to 336,000. That's then half of all school-aged children. And as I say, then the balance there remain a priority for UNRWA programming, which includes on-site and online learning. So hopefully that gives you a sense of the numbers, where we are and where we seek to go. For UNICEF, the 135,000 is quite remarkable to have that already, only 3 months of a ceasefire. But the enormity of need is we want to increase that by 150% in the next 12 months. So it's a mix of where students are. There's a lot of tents. There's a lot of buildings that have been damaged, but not structurally at a point where they're dangerous. And these are not always schools. Communities are utilising any facility whatsoever. They put education as a priority. So any facility that can function, then UNICEF will come in and at the same time make sure then that there's some hand washing and toilets. But tents do make up a huge amount of these classrooms. So they really are very, very temporary, which means in winter they're cold, which means in summer they'll be scorchingly hot. So for the majority, it's tents. A lot of teachers, yes, there are still a lot of teachers. There's a lot of volunteers who are going through some basic training. So it's a mix of those two things. A lot of community volunteers and existing teachers at the moment to make up. And remembering, we're talking for UNICEF getting half of those 700,000 in. So it's not the full complement. That will be a much bigger effort over the next year or two. And I think it's just to say as well that when we look at the type of schools, right now, our priority is very much about getting children back in immediately. But that is often under canvases in community centres. They can't wait for that brick and mortar. But that's a very important part, Christian, that needs to happen. So this, you know, phase two isn't just a political milestone. It's a humanitarian necessity. So we go beyond a humanitarian response, a life-saving response, and we go into shelter. We go into large-scale improvements into shelter, more durable housing, and we go into schooling as well. But for right now, it's any space we can possibly secure safely for children.
I just have a very quick clarification. Do you know anything about the other 350,000 that used to go to UNRWA schools? Are they in or out of school?
Okay, my understanding is that, but I check with UNRWA, is that, and again, lots of numbers, but if you're scribbling them down, of that other half of that 700,000, around 145,000 of those are registered for in-person learning through UNRWA. But I would defer to UNRWA on that one.
Yeah, absolutely. We could...
So just,
double back to them and maybe get clarification on that. Sorry, go ahead, James. I cut you off. You were going to add something else.
No, not at all. It's a really important one to kind of break down the break down those numbers. And I think it gives a sense of the enormity of how much we still have to do. But at the same time, if you've got that many children registered for in-person learning through UNRWA, UNICEF's already managed 135,000. We're looking at increasing that by 150%. It does speak again to the importance, the criticality that Palestinians put on education, that they'll do anything. It's I think one thing that I haven't conveyed very well, Christiane, over the last 2 years of reporting is just how many children are still studying. So you go into tents and they explain what their day is, waking up, often cold, going in search of water, but then how often there's one child out of three who are still doing in-person learning. And so in the evening, the others take on all the duties. So that particular child, that 14-year-old girl or 16-year-old boy, so they can study in some way. It's been one of the many frustrations about the most basic sense of getting in solar lights. If you ask any Palestinian what they need, just as a family, it's often like a light so we can study at nighttime and vitamins for children. So they've done everything and children have been still doing those exams. When I was at Al-Shifa Hospital 2 weeks ago, a few days earlier, there had been a graduation ceremony, the first since the attacks on Gaza. So we were talking hundreds of doctors in the outside, you know, the backdrop of the ruins of Al-Shifa, who had graduated, who'd done their years of university and then done their 2 years during that war, 2 years of, you know, in placement in hospitals. So Palestinians have done everything they can to keep it going, but it has been under an unprecedented assault, both in terms of devastation to systems and just blockades. Now, we have very good news now. We have got in, I'll get you the numbers, but we have now in the last days got in thousands of recreational kits, hundreds of school in a carton kits. We're looking at getting 2,500 more school in a carton kits in the next week because they've been approved. That's all in the last week. That's on the back of enormous amounts of private advocacy and on the back of media making it clear for 2 years education materials have been blocked. We hope that's the end of that, but it's been a long 2 years for children and for organisations like UNICEF to try and do that education without those materials. It looks like we're finally seeing a real change.
Absolutely. Thanks very much, James. Okay, we'll take a question from Olivia of Reuters now.
Good morning, James. Thank you. A few questions. What's going to happen to the remaining 14,000 children out of that 350,000? You said you're aiming to reach 336,000. Is there a reason why 14,000 are missing from that figure? Do you have any figures on the number of number of schools that were destroyed during the war? Also, it would be helpful to have a sense of geographical scale of where you're scaling up. Is it mainly in the south? Are you having more issues trying to re-establish learning in the north of Gaza, namely, for example, Gaza City? Safety of children getting to school. There have been a number of children killed since the ceasefire. Perhaps actually you have an updated figure on that you might be able to share with us, but any concern on ensuring that children can actually access education safely? And finally, on the school kits you're mentioning, could you just explain exactly what they are, what they contain? Do they include, like, for example, books and pencils, which I know had been previously blocked in some cases? And you're saying that, you know, now they're finally getting through. Is that through? Yeah, if you could say through which crossing and any more figures you have on that would be great. Thank you.
Okay, so I think I missed the second one, but so I wouldn't get stuck on the. I don't think there are 14. I don't think the aim is that the 14,000 would miss out. I know that. When we've looked at spaces and where we can be, the aim is a realistic, and it's a big push to go from zero, you know, a number of months ago to 336,000. And then, of course, remembering what a programmatic priority this is for UNRWA. So I think between us, and certainly under the guidance of the Palestinian Authorities Ministry of Education, the target is all 700,000. There is no doubt on that one. Now, I'll come back on the second one because I did miss it. The bulk of the population, for the third question, Olivia, the bulk of the population, yes, still sits in that central southern area. It is very difficult still in the north. made consistently so by the yellow line and by continuation of children, as you say, being killed or wounded. That hasn't stopped. So the north is harder. The north is more remote. The north is much less services. I saw a temporary learning space that we had just set up a couple of weeks ago next door to a primary healthcare clinic. It's the only one in the north. It's a magnet for people. There's an immense amount of gratitude that they are there, but it's very, very hard for people to access if they're the only services. So the majority are central and south. It's more than 100 children killed or wounded. I'm not sure I can get you a precise. I know that certainly there was a substantial number in the last week, and it was 2 weeks ago that I briefed on that. To give you a sense of what's in these kits, in a school in a box, you're talking about materials to play with: cubes, woods, plastic, scissors, crayons, packs, pencils, pens, tapes, flip charts, markers, chalk, brushes, paintboards, compasses, pencils. You can see I'm reading this out. I can send this around to everyone if you need. Erasers. All the basics: exercise books, ballpoint pens, and so on and so on. All the things that we have been prevented from bringing in for more than 2 years that are the most basic education supplies for a child. And that segues into that now we are in phase two. We certainly also need to look at things that should have been allowed in the last 2 years, but now other things, all those dual use items that are so important for more durable temporary housing, I think are very important. These have still come through Karam Shalom, but we hope to see many, many more crossings open. Access, as you rightly say, there are also dangers with unexploded ordinances, and part of what temporary learning spaces can offer is education around that and some mental health support. So these are critically important. In terms of safety of children getting to schools or getting anywhere in the Gaza Strip, the onus is very clear. This is a ceasefire. It's incredulous that 100 children or more than 100 children have been killed. We can only hope and keep making those demands that number does not increase by another single child now that we're in phase two. But we shouldn't have had to say that during phase one. So, Olivia, it's only your second question in between where children are and the 14,000.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, it was about the number of schools destroyed. Is that right? And James, in terms of school kits, anything you could share with us that we can even link to in the summary to illustrate the importance of material that are in those school kits? But on the number of schools destroyed, that would be helpful. Thanks.
Yeah, good call. When I send this around, I will send a whole list of what's in those education and recreation kits. I mean, recreation kits, Olivia, I think are one of the best things I've seen, in my two decades with UNICEF, any community from, Southern Africa to East Asia, because they're just play. So they can be coloured pencils, but they're a ball, they're a pump, they're bibs, for children to wear. There's nets. So sports for girls, sports for boys. And again, the idea, an immense thing that we can now get these by the thousands into Gaza. But one has to ask for this, for almost 2.5 years, why on earth were these possibly banned? I don't know the number of schools. It's one for UNRWA, but I can certainly search it, and I will come back to you, Olivia, on that devastating a number that speaks to the level of devastation of education facilities.
Thank you so much, James. And we can also seek some clarity from UNRWA as well. Next question. Okay, we have Alexander, then Anadolu from AFP.
Yeah, thank you for taking my question. Just wondering first, how old are those 336,000 children? What is the age range, please? And also we're wondering, you were talking about UNRWA, how are they able to help you with this, given the different assaults Israel gave against the agency? And lastly, we're also wondering, given the situation right now with the ceasefire, how are you able to get enough supplies in And can you tell us also if anything comes through Rafah?
Adela, thank you. So school-age children, so ages of 5 to 18, and it's an important point you raise because also, you know, the world has learned over 20 years of the criticality of early childhood education as well. That's children under 5. We are talking here school age, but there are just over 300,000 children who would fit into that early childhood development, which is, and so it's another critical cohort. Your second one around Urnie, yes, as everyone has made clear for such a long time that, you know, the 10, 12,000 Palestinian UNRWA staff are a backbone of a health system, backbone of an education system. So they remain that. And I think that UNRWA does a huge amount of online learning. And as I say, it will definitely, I understand, very much part of their programming to get in-person learning at a very large scale again. So this is a complementary effort. I just can't speak to their actual numbers. But certainly in terms of their ability to function, they still have thousands and thousands of those teachers and health workers across the Gaza Strip, many of whom will be supporting in this initiative. And your last one, was on Rafah.
Yes.
Alex,
is
that right?
Correct.
Yes. Yes. In the last week, one of our deputy executive directors met with Israeli authorities, again asked them to open more routes for humanitarian and commercial supplies. That's really critical. I think UNICEF and WFP have been responsible for around 80% of humanitarian supplies since the ceasefire, but we still know it's not enough. So the ask was very clear. It was to allow people to move in and out safely for medical care. The lack of medical evacuations is still costing lives on pretty much a daily basis. So allow that free movement of people for medical evacuations, for family reunification and for essential services. And he made that call again for the Rafah corridor to be open for two-way traffic, as it's been announced. But again, so we can have that, so populations can move, so it can be yet another entry point, of which there's several others that need to be opening as well. But with a heavy emphasis, because Rafah really was that lifeline until it was closed midway in 2024 for children and civilians who require urgent medical evacuation.
Thanks so much. And needless to say, the Secretary General continues to urge all parties to facilitate sustained and unhindered humanitarian access, including through the Rafah crossing, which, as James just mentioned, is indeed a very important lifeline. So let's take another question in the room. Beza Anadolu.
Thank you, Rolando. Thank you, James, for the briefing. I would like to ask about the remarks of the Israeli Prime Minister. He said yesterday the next phase of the ceasefire will not be about reconstruction, but it's going to focus on demilitarizing Gaza. And as you said, 90% of the schools have been damaged. And how you evaluate those remarks? Are you concerned? What would be the impact of this to the education and for the children if the reconstruction is not being priority anymore in the phase two? And also on the Rafah, I want to build on Alexander's question and ask you, or maybe Ocha can chime in as well, aware of any movement in the Rafah, because Israeli side was saying after the return of the last hostage remaining, we would be opening the Rafah. So are you aware of any movement in the border? Thank you.
Reza, thanks. I will speak to it. I'd rather not speak in response to any comments made from officials, but yeah, there shouldn't be any need for interpretation. Phase two is pretty clear. As I say, it's not a political milestone. It's a humanitarian necessity. It enables us to go beyond phase one, which was a life-saving response, into more durable things, particularly, as we say, shelter. You've all seen it. I can speak to it time and again. Those 2-year-old windswept tents on beaches that are horrendous for a couple of hours. It's impossible to know how children get wet and then are able to get warm again. We've now had At least 10 children confirmed die from hypothermia. So phase two, and that wouldn't have happened if we had more durable shelters in. There's just simply no doubt of that. So phase two, like all things, is welcome, but it comes at a time when we've already had unnecessary child deaths. So phase two will allow for those large-scale improvements into things like shelter and into things like schooling. My apologies. The second part of your question, Ezra?
Are you aware of any movement in the Rafah? Because as they said, after the return of the last hostage remainings, they would be opening.
No, I'm not. And I have daily contact with Palestinians who are desperate to for that to open, for the reasons that probably don't get spoken about enough. How many families have been separated? How many, you know, dads have been doing a WhatsApp video call once a week when connectivity allows for 2 years for their children, or children who were, you know, 5 and 9 and are now 7 and 11. That's happening to thousands and thousands. So there is a great desperation in a personal sense for families beyond the medical evacuation sense. And the most simple, no, at the moment we haven't, but certainly phase two means there are no more excuses for Rafah not to open.
Absolutely. Thank you, James. I think we have one further question in the room, and that might do it. So, Boris, over to you.
Boris Engelson, a freelancer. In the entire world, the formal standard school system is being questioned and sometimes challenged. It seems that only emergency situation still cling 100% to the traditional 19th century school model. So did I get wrong what I heard so far?
Help me out, Boris, with the links to historical, the way education is still done, but the link to Gaza?
Elaborate, Boris.
I have bad hearing, so I'm not sure what you ask me, but we have heard for years now that education cannot wait and that so many millions of children don't have school in emergency situation, Gaza or refugee camps. But at the same time, the school system in Europe, America, and most of the world does not work anymore. People, teachers, pupils are fed up with that, try to find another model, but the only place where apparently informal and new channels of education are not being reflected upon or implemented seem to be where it would be most needed and most easy, that is emergency situation. So since I have bad hearing, usually I only hear one quarter of what experts say, but in that quarter I never heard anything about new models of education and schooling in new contexts, even let's say tragic context.
Thank you. Look, I think I'm happy to direct your question on that historical sense on where education is going, where it should go in countries in the northern or southern hemisphere. I don't have that expertise, but I very much understand what you're alluding to. Gaza is in some ways always taking on new initiatives. Gaza, what UNICEF is doing in terms of our temporary learning spaces is only English, Arabic, maths and science. But Palestinians, I don't think I've found a single one of the thousands I've spoken to or hundreds I've spoken to who questioned that. So the style of learning may still be, you know, old school, pardon the pun, but their commitment to it and their study for it is why they produce so many engineers and doctors and those STEM people. They work incredibly hard. So I don't think at this moment they're questioning that style of education. They just want access to it. And of course, for industrious young people, if they have an internet connectivity, if they can go to school for 4 hours a day and then they have an internet connectivity, then they will do their own type of schooling. As I've met many people there who are creating greenhouses, who have learned fluent English or are creating solar-powered bicycles, all on the back of the internet. So I don't think we can understate the ability and ingenuity of Palestinians, but I think you have a fair question and do reach out to me on that historical sense of where education's going globally.
Thank you, and I'll always be keen on learning more on that issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Boris. Thank you very much, James. So we have one further question. Nick, New York Times.
Yeah, thank you for taking the question. Hi, James. Slightly sort of long-distance question, but I'm trying to reconcile. I appreciate your focus is on immediate relief, but I'm trying to reconcile the conditions you're dealing with the kind of images of Gaza shared by Jared Kushner at Davos. I'm wondering to what extent there has been any engagement with UNICEF that on Palestinian education in the reconstructed Gaza, and what you may be aware of in terms of whether or not there's any space for Palestinian education in the plans that are being developed. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Nick. So, earlier this week, our Deputy Executive Director was meeting with Israeli authorities, was at the meeting at the CMCC, meeting a range of Palestinian technocrats as well, making the point time and again on the criticality of education, on this initiative, on allowing school supplies in. So we've seen some success there. You're right, in terms of other imagery and so on, we don't see the appropriate nod to the criticality of education, nor to just how embedded in the culture of Gaza it is and how it has enabled them to bounce back so many times. So I think at all levels, from the Secretary General to the resident coordinator on the ground, whatever access they can possibly have with those major players in the Board of Peace, then that is one of the first messages that we are conveying. As I say in that brief, it's so perfectly clear in Gaza, as is elsewhere, that this is a life-saving response above and beyond some of the, as you say, magnificent buildings that we see in some of those PowerPoint presentations. The nuts and bolts for UNICEF is that education is absolutely on the podium of priorities. Now it's up to us to try and ensure that message is conveyed to those decision makers.
You said it. Thanks so much, James. Appreciate that. Indeed, these are improvements, some good news, but still amidst a continuing precarious situation. So thank you very much, James, as always, joining us here at this briefing. So that ends it, I believe, that's it for you, James. Thanks again. We're going to move on then to an announcement from David, who's now on the podium with me. David Hirsch of the International Telecommunication Union has an announcement for us.
Thank you, Rollo. The International Submarine Cable Resilience Summit 2026 will take place in Porto, Portugal, from the 2nd to the 3rd of February. The event brings together governments, regulators, industry representatives, and other experts to strengthen technical collaboration on submarine cable resilience. Among the technical issues to be discussed include timely deployment and repair of cables, risk identification, monitoring and mitigation, and supporting connectivity and geographic diversity. As a reminder, submarine cables carry more than 99% of international data traffic. There are about 150 to 200 faults each year, with the majority of those faults coming from human activities such as phishing. The event is organized by ITU and the International Cable Protection Committee, ICPC. It is hosted by the government of Portugal, and it follows last year's meeting in Nigeria. We issued an advisory yesterday. Reporters can request accreditation at our email, pressreg@itu.int, and a webcast of the event is also available.
Thank you so much, David. Any questions for David? Online? Oh, yes, Catherine. France Foncat.
Good morning, David, and good morning, Rolando. David, would it be possible to send us the list of events that are going to take care in 2026? ITU events. Thank you so much.
I'll start off, but I think because it integrates well into what Rolando might have to say on this, what we do, I think, regularly provide a list to the spokesperson's office, and I don't know if it's already gone out, but I believe Rolo's office will put out a list of events. Not all events are known to us yet, but those that are known and that are open for press coverage, we would certainly make sure are part of that.
That's right, David. Indeed, we do send out at the beginning of the year, and I believe we had a holdup because of some uncertainties about some of the human rights treaty bodies in particular. It's a telegraphic list, but it does list all the key events coming up in the forecast ahead, including ITU events. So I'll follow up on that, and let's make sure you get that for your planning. So thank you, Catherine. Do you have another question? No? Okay. We could also follow up with you directly if you like. Jamie, you have a question for David? AP?
I do. Thank you, Rolanda. Thank you. Nice to see you both, David. My question was just, there have been a number of instances of alleged sabotage or willful attacks on undersea cables. I'm wondering if ITU pulls together data on that. Do you have statistics on suspected cases of that? Thanks.
Jamie, from the work that ITU does, we can say that the overwhelming majority of instances where there are these disruptions or faults, 150 to 200 a year, the order of about 3 a week, that those are the majority, about 80% are from fishing, human activities such as fishing, anchor dragging. There are other instances such as aging equipment faults. There's also natural hazards, earthquakes, tsunamis that can impact the cables. ITU does not have the statistics itself with that kind of detail clarity, but we do use industry sources for that, and our partner in the summit, the International Cable Protection Committee, could be a reliable source for data such as that.
Okay, well noted. Thank you so much, David. Further questions for David? No, that's not the case, so thanks as always. And good luck with the upcoming event. Just a couple of announcements, colleagues. Just wanted to flag, firstly, that we shared with you yesterday a statement from the Secretary General that he delivered to the Security Council on the rule of law. And he notes how the rule of law is being replaced by the rule of the jungle, quote unquote. He says, we see flagrant violations of international law and brazen disregard for the UN Charter. Secretary General Oates also noted that from Gaza to Ukraine, from the Sahel to Myanmar, and in Venezuela and elsewhere, the rule of law is being treated as an a la carte menu. It's an important statement, which I would encourage you to read, that we shared with you last night. An event taking place here, I would encourage you to attend if you can at 1 p.m. in room 16 today. To mark today is International Day of the Commemoration and Memory of the Victims of the Holocaust. It's 81 years since the liberation of the concentration camps, and we have an event to mark this important observance today, the 27th of January, at 1 p.m., room 16 again. This is an annual occurrence which is mandated by the General Assembly, as you well know. We have a message from Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General, that will be displayed. We have remarks from the Director General of UNOG, Ms. Valavaya. And we also have a keynote address from Ms. Leonie De Picciotto, who's a Holocaust survivor. As always, this event features an interview with the Holocaust survivor. So I would encourage you to attend, if you can, at 1 p.m., room 16. Human rights treaty body meetings. We have the Committee on the Rights of the Child, which is continuing its work this week. It will conclude its 100th session this coming Friday, the 30th of January. Tomorrow, let's see, there is a meeting with states scheduled for Thursday afternoon. At the end of the meeting, or at the end of the session, rather, on Friday, it will issue its concluding observations for the countries it reviewed during this session, namely for Maldives, Ghana, Pakistan, Ethiopia, Colombia, Spain, and Malaysia. And you'll receive those as usual. Two more quick ones. UPR, Universal Periodic Review, also continues its session this week. We have today the review going on at present. The St. Kitts and Nevis review is taking place in this afternoon at Sao Tome and Principe. Friday afternoon, the reports for the remaining states will all be adopted by this working group, namely for Micronesia, Lebanon, Mauritania, Nauru, Rwanda, Nepal, St. Lucia, Oman, Austria, Australia, Georgia, St. Kitts and Nevis, and Sao Tome and Principe. Did you get all that? I'm going to ask you if you remembered that. Now, on the last note, I've been asked to announce an event that is taking place. It's more of a memorial event, and this is a rather somber note, but I think it's important. I feel obligated to say something because I know many of you are bicyclists. I'm looking at some of you myself. I'm a biker, and there was a tragic incident which took place, as you probably have heard. It was an ILO, a young woman, 28-year-old woman, who was killed, sadly, not far from here. And Giuseppe Motta on the 15th of December, Elizabeth Weathersby is her name, and she was an ILO employee. Now, in her memory, and to raise awareness about road safety in this the Nacion's neighborhood, a commemorative ceremony will be held at the site of the accident. So that will be taking place this Thursday, the 29th of January, at 5:30. So the location is specifically the parking lot of the ITU. So this is the corner of Mota and Camille Vidal. So this Thursday at 5:30 for our fallen colleague, Elizabeth Weathersby. Any questions for me before we wrap up? Yes, Olivia.
Thank you. Sorry, this is actually a question for IOM because I just saw that they are on the call, like hopefully mm-hmm. still on the call.
Yep.
Just a question in relation to the number of shipwrecks, concerns about dozens dead or missing following the press release that you put out yesterday. I was just wondering, since then, if there's been any further update that you can give us. Thanks.
Thanks, Olivia. I think Kennedy, yeah, there is. Go ahead.
Thanks, Olivia. So far, we haven't had any updates. What we had and what we issued yesterday is basically the latest that we have from the incident. I'll try and keep track, follow up with the colleagues in the Mediterranean and see whether there's any update on the numbers, and then I'll come back to you if at all there's been any. But so far, what we had issued yesterday is the numbers that we currently have. Thanks.
Okay, fair enough. Thanks. Yeah, if you can come back to us on any more details. Go ahead, Boris.
Today, from what I read, there is a study day on the history of multilateralism taking place in relation with the UN archives, League of Nations archives. It's not clear if it's at the library. I don't know if the library is open or room S5. Will an accredited journalist be allowed to attend?
Thank you, Board. Let me look into that. The library building, as you know, given the ongoing construction works, is closed. But they have relocated their archives to a different building and the compound. But let me look into this specific event, or maybe afterwards we can liaise, and then I could try to get information whether you can attend this event or not. Thank you very much. Any further questions, colleagues? I see a microphone on, but not a hand. So I think that does it. Thank you very much. See you this afternoon, perhaps. And if not this afternoon, on Friday at this briefing. Thank you so much.